Here we are, continuing in our sort of conversational exposition through the laws given in Exodus chapter 21 through 23. And we come right to the beginning here, Exodus chapter 21, verses 2, 3, and 4. One of you guys read this.
If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years. And in the seventh, he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself.
Okay, stop right there. The very first phrase there found in verse 2, if you buy a Hebrew servant. That's talking about the institution of slavery, at least in some form, in ancient Israel. And I think that this is something we have to reckon with right here, that in the ancient world and in Israel among them, there were people who worked for others on the principle of servitude. They were slaves in some sense, though not necessarily in the way that many people regard slavery, for example, in American history.
Well, I would say, I think of slavery, I think Civil War, Underground Railroad, that type of thing.
Roots, so that whole thing. Yes.
So, I mean, is the Bible responsible?
Which, by the way, just a few days ago, was the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Oh, wow.
Something that was prompted by Christian effort. So anyway, what was your question there?
My question was, could someone say, well, is the Bible then responsible for slavery? If here we have it.
You know, you hear that, but don't you think, doesn't that question drive you crazy? It drives me crazy. Because the idea that somehow the Bible is responsible for slavery, look, slavery existed before the Bible. It exists outside of cultures that have never been touched by the Bible. Slavery is almost the norm. The question isn't why is there slavery? The question is why has there been emancipation? And it's been because of biblical truth that emancipation has taken place, that slaves have been set free. It hasn't been because of the otherwise. So slavery is almost natural among the brutal, humanity that we find all around us. No, the real question is why have there been emancipation movements? And that has been only out of the Christian impulse.
Well, Spurgeon has an interesting quote in regards to this.
Yeah.
And he says this, Moses did not institute slavery in any shape. He didn't put it into practice.
No.
He says the laws concerning it were made on purpose to repress it, to confine it within very narrow bounds, and ultimately to put an end to it. So it says, what he's saying there essentially is that it's not responsible for slavery, but it really helps in the treatment of slaves, in what it looks like, and ultimately end it.
Yes, and you find the same principle carried over to the New Testament, where masters and slaves are commanded to regard each other as brothers in Christ. And this was sort of, in a sense, the death knell to slavery. Now look, I believe it is a fair question and debatable. Why did God not immediately end slavery instead of sort of introducing the slow-acting poison that would humanize it and then eventually eliminate it? Well, that's a fair debatable question, but that's not really the question at hand. Here God is saying, this institution that is universal among the cultures of the ancient world, Israel, this is how I want you to treat your servants.
It's kind of interesting that he starts with this, too. I mean, that's just kind of a weird place to start off this whole section of law.
Of all the laws that you could begin with.
Yeah.
To instruct judges, the first place is how to humanely treat your servants.
Yeah.
That's significant. Okay, now, a Hebrew servant, it mentions that there in verse 2. How might a Hebrew become a servant to another person? How did it work?
Well, wasn't it in the case maybe of extreme poverty? And they might sell their freedom, their liberty.
Okay, now today someone might declare bankruptcy if they had debts that they couldn't pay. They didn't have that institution in ancient Israel. So what do? A person would sell themselves in sort of what we used to call an indentured servant in order to pay off the debt. That's one way. Any others?
Was another way something about perhaps a father and their daughter would in a sense sell their daughter to a family, but in hope or possible
anticipation
of a marriage into the family.
That's right. And we're going to see that a little bit later on, actually in the next section that we do, starting at verse 7. That's two more.
Well, we mentioned the idea of bankruptcy. Maybe the creditors are at the door.
Right.
Doesn't have the money.
Right. So it could be poverty not related to bankruptcy, or it could be poverty related to bankruptcy. That's a third. Or then finally, I guess there's one more one in our notes that we could talk about.
If a thief had nothing with which to pay proper restitution.
Okay, you steal, maybe you use or break the thing that you stole. You're commanded to pay restitution, but you have no money. Did it mean, well, then you don't have anything to pay? No. You had to become a hired servant to that person, or I should say an unhired servant to that person and work for them. But look, this is what we need to realize. The idea of what we might call, I know it's kind of a Victorian phrase to use, man-stealing, where they would kidnap slaves, take them to other cultures, and make them be slaves for life, that's not what we're talking about here in these laws of ancient Israel. That was not practiced from Hebrew to Hebrew there in the ancient world.
Well, yes. That's very interesting, because a lot of, you know, like we were talking about, how does this transfer over into today's world? Because that's a lot of what's going on today, is that there is this forcible slavery that's inflicted upon from children all the way up into adults.
Well, David, I mean, I read things from time to time. Aren't there millions and millions of people in slavery today in the world?
Millions. Millions. And a lot of people think that it doesn't exist. But it exists both here in the West, but then also in the East. It's a worldwide thing.
Well, you know, don't we come back to this all the time? What a beautiful thing it would be if the world observed the laws of God. And this idea of let me get to, there's three features of slavery in the Hebrew world that were distinctive. Number one, it was always chosen or mutually arranged. I'm not saying that the person who had to become a servant because he couldn't pay his debts, he was happy about it. He wasn't happy about it, but he knew he had to do it. I mean, this is just what you had to do. So it was either chosen or mutually arranged. It was of limited duration. They weren't slaves for life. And as we're going to find out, what the very next phrase gives the duration. But then finally, it was also highly regulated. So here now, I think it's in verse 3, it speaks of a term for how long somebody would serve. What does it say there?
Verse 3?
Well, he shall serve
6 years, and the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing.
Okay. So the service was never to be lifelong. He was to work for 6 years and then to be set free. Again, this is much more like indentured servanthood than we're talking about the idea of this perpetual lifelong slavery.
It's almost like a contract that they had with the owner, quote-unquote owner of themselves, is that they had the contract, is I will serve you for 6 years.
It is.
Knowing the seventh, I will be
exactly set free. Exactly. And this is something, I don't know. Sometimes I read commentators, I wonder if they're being a little too benign or pleasant about it. But G. Campbell Morgan said that this was more like an apprenticeship program in many cases. That a young father who perhaps couldn't train his child in a trade would sell them for 6 years into an apprenticeship program with a man who would teach him a trade and give him a grounding, and he'd have to work with him without pay. The master, so to speak, would be responsible for feeding him and housing him. And at the end of the time, the guy left and was free, and he had a trade that he had learned. I don't know if that's treating it a little bit too benignly. We don't want to, you know, be in fairy tale land about this, but you can see what G. Campbell Morgan was getting at with that.
It's more really like the idea of an employer and employee.
Well, and don't you think that that's where we find tremendous relevance to this today? In at least our part of the Western world, slavery may be rare. I mean, we would hope that it's rare in Santa Barbara and in the Western world, although it certainly does exist. We don't want to minimize that. But certainly, people work for other people. They have employment and work obligations. Sometimes they feel like slaves, don't they? But even so, they have obligations in the midst of this. So what he was supposed to serve for this limited duration, and then I find it interesting how it says here, starting here at verse 4, if he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. At the end of the 6 years, the servant came out with what he went in with. In other words, if the master provided a wife and therefore children, then the wife and the children had to stay with the master until what? Until they could be purchased out. Because here's the other thing about slavery. It could always be redeemed. It could always be purchased out. Now, let's say you had debts or obligations that you couldn't pay. you went into servitude. The one thing, it couldn't last for more than 6 years. That's number one. Number two, it could always be bought out. Somebody could go in and fulfill the obligation, could meet the debt, could satisfy the obligation, and then that would end it. So anything here in closing, guys, just as we take a look at these first few verses, anything, this idea of the potential for being bought out of slavery, does that suggest anything to you two?
Well, I think it's really interesting because the Bible talks about us being slaves to sin.
Absolutely.
And
is that for 6 or 7 years?
That's for ever.
For life until you're set free.
Exactly.
Yes.
But you speak of the things that someone can go and pay the price to redeem you out of that slavery. Yes. Well, that points to Jesus.
You know, if you think about it, how can a slave ever raise the money himself? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't think of a slave having a side job. I mean, maybe, I'm not saying it's impossible, but that's just not the way you normally think of it. He needs somebody from the outside to come and do it. And how's that work, Nate?
Oh, man, to think that Jesus himself would come and pay the price that we owed, that he would come on our behalf. You know, here we were, indentured servants to sin, and Jesus would pay our debt.
That's right. So it's wrong to blame the Bible for the institution of slavery. Biblical truth and freedom is what has abolished slavery, but the greatest abolishment of slavery is what we find given to us by Jesus Christ. Well, that's good. We'll wrap it up for this, and then we'll come back again and continue on in this trip through Exodus chapter 21.